everyone wants more money. Like,
yeah.
You can never be too good looking and you can never have enough money. So,
yeah.
You know, on the most basic of needs from a humanitarian perspective, it solves a lot of problems. And looking at it from a Maslow's needs hierarchy, there are certain needs that need to be met to basically climb up that Maslow's needs hierarchy to effectively self-actualization and being able to give to humanity. I think Bitcoin allows us to scale that hierarchy of needs faster than anything else on Earth.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. This is a podcast all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the people converging on this new form of money. Why do they see value in it? What skills enable their understanding? How is it changing their lives? If you're a founder looking for funding or an investor looking to make investments, then please reach out as I develop my network in the space. Do me a favor and chuck us a 5-star rating on whichever app you're using to listen, or a like if you're watching it somewhere. As insignificant as this may seem, they help a startup project like this hugely. Lastly, if you have any questions at all, please just reach out. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Jake E. S. Woodhouse. Now, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk about our sponsor. Fast Bitcoins are a Bitcoin exchange who you should definitely take a look at next time you're thinking of making a Bitcoin purchase. They're a great team, which for me is always the key to due diligence, whilst their product has a ton of features useful to every Bitcoiner. Check out my episodes with Danny Brewster, the founder CEO, and Nathan Smith, the chief compliance officer, to learn more about the people behind the brand. Thank you to Fast Bitcoins for sponsoring the show. Now, on to today's episode. This evening, I'm speaking with Peter Dunworth. Welcome, Pete. How are you?
Very good to see you, Jack. Thanks for having me.
My absolute pleasure. So of all the characters I've come across in the last kind of 2 years of heavy Bitcoin rabbit hole work, I would say you've had the largest influence on my thinking and have been the most help on that way. So I'm absolutely delighted to have you here this evening to explore, you know, what brings you to the table and what Bitcoin means to you. So shout out to you, Pete. Thank you so much for everything you've done. Now, to start things off, really simple. When did you first hear about Bitcoin and what was going on in your life at the time?
So the first time I heard about Bitcoin was back in probably around 2011. I had my brother, who has been a huge inspiration to me, talk to me about buying some Bitcoin when it was $3. And I told him, that's a silly idea. That's stupid. That'll never work. And pretty much all the things that most Bitcoiners talk about when they first hear the idea of Bitcoin. But that's when I first heard about it. However, Michael established a business back in 2013 and, you know, speaking to him, you know, quite regularly about this, got interested in it. And I'm ashamed to say, but it actually took me about 5 years to figure it out of speaking to him every other day who had a business in it to actually understand what this was, what the value proposition was, and just how groundbreaking this technology could be. So,
well, shout out to Mike, who's obviously been on the show before. So if anyone hasn't listened to that episode, it's recently been released. We all have, well, so much fun with our siblings and so much to thank them for in different parts of life over different subjects. So I'm imagining he's kind of pestering you, being like, mate, $3, you got to buy this stuff. And you're like, whatever, not listening to my younger brother or some such reason. But 5 years later, you kind of realized this is actually something really important. Do you remember what it was that suddenly made the whole thing click? Or what was it that kind of finally piqued your interest?
It's never, for me anyway, it's never one thing that sort of was an aha moment that I was like, oh my goodness, this thing's incredible. Like, you hear Saylor talk about the epiphany he had and then went out and bought 100 million personally and he's away. To Michael's credit, Michael is a, you know, just such a generous soul and he's never pushy with anyone. So it was a passing comment for Michael. It was, hey, this thing looks interesting. You should probably buy some. And it was no more than that. It wasn't evangelical. Hey, you've got to do this. This is the most incredible opportunity ever. It's just, hey, I'm doing this. This looks interesting to me. You should try some. And unfortunately, I was, you know, literally running a financial advice business, which I still do. And I told him, you know, basically I went through the four stages of understanding Bitcoin. I told him that'd never work. And then the government will shut it down. And then, you know, luckily I had him to bounce ideas off. When I came up with the new Bitcoin that's better than Bitcoin, it's faster, or it's got more transactions, or it's got more throughput, or whatever the marketing gimmick is, I was very fortunate that I had Michael there to basically tell me that none of that stuff matters. It's really, immutability is, you know, probably the golden principle of Bitcoin, which he and I describe as being a pet rock, that it doesn't do anything, but that's the feature, not the bug. So it was just through conversations over and over again, sort of picking up things that, you know, over a 5-year period, I got to see $3 go to $1,000, and I was like, oh wow, this is incredible. And then I watch it crash to $200, thinking, oh, this thing's exactly as I planned. So you know, instantly discard it, thinking that, oh hey, I'm right, aren't I smart? It's like, no, you're not. You just haven't done the work yet. And sadly for me, I haven't done
it. Oh, look, it's crash. Oh well, I was right.
and that's usually the attitude you have. And sadly, and this is what I've spent a lot of time thinking about, because there are so many novel innovations with Bitcoin, there's no real way of valuing the metrics of the intangibles that Bitcoin delivers. And from a financial sense, which is where I spend, you know, my 9 to 5 in that, you know, fiat world, literally giving financial advice and investment advice, there's no earnings, there is a market cap, but it's a very different beast to value. And if you look at the tech innovations attached to it, no one's really come up with a great metric for valuing immutability or absolute scarcity or censorship resistance or seizure resistance. And these are four key tech innovations that we've never seen, has never been possible up until this time. And I think this is where we are literally like astronauts in the 1960s. We haven't seen what this thing's capable of yet. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time on this and I still don't feel like I've scratched the surface.
That's the crazy thing is, isn't it? You think you figured it out, or some of it you figured out, but actually you just end up with more questions. A term I'd love to really unpack a little bit is the one you mentioned about Bitcoin's really just a pet rock. So, you know, some of those terms you just threw around, which are a bit more technical than a pet rock, but let's pretend the person listening out there doesn't understand what you mean by Bitcoin's a pet rock. Can we understand a bit more?
Well, I guess it's a technology that doesn't change. A pet rock fundamentally means it's immutable. It's not able to change. It is going to stay in its state and it's not going to be changed whatsoever. And when you look at the value proposition of Bitcoin, the immutability comes in three forms. The immutability comes in the form of, and what I believe is its most valuable feature, is an immutable ledger, meaning that once a transaction's done, you can't unwind a transaction on that ledger, which for the first time in history, this is the first ledger that we haven't been able to unwind or change. And this is a hugely powerful tool because all of a sudden there's no rewriting history by the winners, because there's a blockchain that is going to basically supersede the winners in a historical context from a war. So typically up until this point in time when there was a war, basically the winners wrote the records or the history of what happened in that event. And typically they whitewashed, you know, oh, aren't we wonderful and aren't they terrible? And, you know, everyone who reads history basically sides with the winners, because it's like, oh, well, how do you not side with the winner? They wrote the history, they make themselves look good. You don't win, you look like a loser, or you're painted out to be a terrible person. And truth is, you know, it's never as good and it's never as bad as what people make out. And this is where, for the first time in history, you have a ledger where you're going to be able to see and look back in hundreds of years as to every transaction on the blockchain. And it's going to be as it was in our time, when people 200 or 300 years in the future are looking back on that. And because we've never seen this, it's never been available, we've never had this technology, we've got no way of even comprehending what the value of that is. And then when you tie in absolute scarcity to it, then it, you know, it's obviously an easy conclusion to come to the fact that it's a gold argument. It's going to compete with gold because it's a store of value. Gold's based on scarcity, so this is based on scarcity. That's a $10 trillion market cap, but by my calculations, the unit of account, you know, modality of use cases for money is roughly 200 times bigger than a store of value market cap. So I look at that and I think, well, a triple entry ledger system, which is fundamentally what Bitcoin is far more valuable than a double entry ledger system. And this is where I love the work that Darren Feinstein's done. Mm-hmm. He's done a few pods where he expands on that concept probably better than anyone I've seen. And having an accounting background at university and, you know, being around finance, this is something that I don't think we as a community really pay homage to or acknowledge, that yes, we understand it's a key feature, but we don't understand how big a feature this is because we're literally just growing into it. It's never been seen before.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it, when you start to think about how little we really know in connection to Bitcoin, like what difference this thing might make. And I really love the concept of coins like a foundation. So as you mentioned, it's like your pet rock, right? This thing just simply doesn't change. It can't be changed. And therefore, as a building block, like what's a good building block? A bit of quicksand that is constantly changing, that you have no idea what's going to happen next, that someone else controls, or something that's never changed in its history and is unlikely to ever change ever again. Well, the second of those two options sounds far, far better place to, you know, spend time to build a business or whatever you might be wanting to do. Well, it's massive, isn't it? Let's try and compare that then. So your day job is a financial, let's take a bit of a history tour and teach us about how you became a financial advisor, why you became a financial advisor. And then I'd love to look at some of those calculation techniques that you use in traditional financial advisory businesses and compare that to Bitcoin. We'll get to that later. So did you always want to get into investing and helping people with their money?
As a optimistic and maybe a little bit aspirational 20, 21 year old, I'm sure. I thought I wanted to be an investment banker and earn $1 million a year. I thought I wanted to work, you know, 168 hours a week just on deals and getting this done, and thought that was a fabulous way to spend my life, until I met a great friend and a great mentor of mine, a guy called Troy, who basically advised me that that wasn't for me and that I should come and do mortgages, where it's a much smaller talent pool. And if you've got any talent or you're prepared to work hard, you can look really good and do okay. So straight out of uni, I went into BT Funds, then set up a business mortgage broking. I spent nearly 10 years there. And then my father's advisor, who was chairman of one of our largest financial institutions just before the GFC, told me I was on the wrong side of the balance sheet and needed to move from debt to equity. So went through retooling to effectively give advice on equities and financial advice. And then spent basically that time for the next 7 or so years in the financial advice space. And then my cousin basically joined me in a private multifamily office where we now look after maybe a dozen high net worth families. And we have some ancillary clients who we look after purely on a Bitcoin education, custody and security basis.
And of which I should openly say and confess, I am a customer. So I'm a huge fan of the product that you guys have created, which, let's just hover on that for a moment. If you buy Bitcoin, and you know, in my case, it's my inheritance. My father died when I was young. You do not want to get in a situation where if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, you don't end up sending that value to the next generation. And so I've teamed up with Pete, who's got a service in which he holds a key. And we have a multi-sig vault, which is impregnable, essentially. And it helps me sleep at night, knowing that if something was to happen, Pete can step in and help make sure that my wife or the rest of my family was to receive what was theirs. It's very cool that that's something that's kind of organically grown. And it's something that I see personally happening in the wealth advisory space globally. But we're just very, very early. It just hasn't happened yet. There's probably not many people out there that are talking about allocating their family investment funds into Bitcoin. They haven't figured it out yet. But was it from the financial advisory world, like in a day as a financial advisor, what are you doing and how do you calculate value and how do you help people protect their wealth over time?
That's a great question. It's very deep. Under Australian law, we have what's called an Australian Financial Services License, and financial advisors, which technically I'm not, I'm classified as something else at the moment, but traditional retail financial advice is structured under basically one of the major banks or an independent financial advice group. And what happens there is the head office basically dictates and mandates what are going to be the investment products that you can sell. They pick what's accessible, what you can advise on, what you can't advise on. So they pick the insurance product, they pick the investment products. And understanding that as an individual advisor working under a license from a what they call a dealer group, you fast understand that as an advisor, you've got zero input into advising clients on Bitcoin, unless you're an independent financial advisor registered, which is what we are. And this is where we get to pick out what our clients' investments are. So on a day-to-day basis, we want to find the best investments for clients. ASIC wants to create a regulation, a framework where you ask clients a number of questions to understand the know your client rule, to understand risk profiles, to understand risk tolerances and what type of investments are going to be suitable for them. Without sort of wanting to gain the ire of ASIC, the traditional, I guess, risk assessment forms, I think, have been heavily skewed to push clients into a product that's called a balanced fund. And this is where a balanced fund might come with the highest set of management fees for a client. Ironically, that where they're pushed into a product that doesn't take too much risk. They put in cash, they put in bonds, they put in property and shares. And for that benefit, the clients charge somewhere between 1% to 2% for a balanced portfolio. But if you took out an individual allocation in direct shares, bonds, and something else, you would end up with a much lower management fee. So it seems a little bit self-serving, a lot of the know your client risk profiles that are undertaken to create sort of an asset allocation for clients. And this is where we're lucky in that we look after sophisticated investors only. We don't look after retail, so we're not subject to those requirements to go and fill out that. But what I find kind of backward in that process is it's like walking onto a plane and basically checking with the pilot that they know how to fly. And it's like, you're not qualified as a passenger on a plane to understand how to fly a plane. So why are you asking them any questions as to how you want to do it? Mm. And this is where, you know, that financial advice process, I think, could be streamlined and made a little bit better if, you know, advisors were given more authority to deliver good advice to clients based on what their goals are, and then delivered education on the back end of that to help them understand what type of risk they need to take in order to achieve those things. And we've had multiple conversations with clients where we've had to deliver bad news and, you know, basically said to them, based on what you want to achieve, what you have right now, we can't deliver on. So we either readjust what you want to, you know, aim for, or alternatively, you want to reassess the level of risk that you want to take.
It's so interesting as well that you use that phrase, self-serving, because as someone at least who's sat on the end of the sales pitch of many financial advisors, the welcome is, you know, open arms. You know, we can help you save your money. We can help you look after what's yours for the rest of your life. You know, in one case, they were like, you know, our aim is very simple, not to lose money. But it is difficult to know, like, what's true and what's not true. And that whole phrase of self-serving, this is one of the reasons why I like Bitcoin so much, because you can see what it is. And if you do the work, you understand that. And you don't need to trust a financial advisor to look after your wealth in many ways. So that brings me nicely to ask, it's when you get a good flavor for the financial advisory industry, like, what is it about Bitcoin that you like in comparison? And what's your experience trying to help people understand it in terms of moving supposedly sophisticated investors' funds across to Bitcoin?
I think on a personal note, I like the ability to understand what this thing is, or I think I've got a very good understanding of what this is. Having said that, when I think I've got an understanding of what it is.
Like we said earlier, yeah. Oh, fuck, actually, I don't know what I'm talking about.
here's a new rabbit hole I never knew. That's the beautiful thing about Bitcoin, but it's so enlightening understanding and learning about Bitcoin, because it puts a different framework on how you assess a whole lot of things in life. And you spend time, you do the work, you can see all of the metrics are completely transparent. You can see the hash rate on the network. You can see the number of nodes. You can see when the last block was mined. They're the three fundamental keys or metrics that I look at to determine whether or not I'm buying or selling. And even despite going through last year, the April drawdown with the Chinese banning Bitcoin mining and losing half the hash rate, everyone understood what that was. And the Bitcoin network performed perfectly. And then when you contrast basically a fair, open and free network where you have complete transparency, when you compare that network to what our current financial system is, which is basically devolved into one man sitting atop a pile of investment, you know, decision makers, where the whole world is literally looking at Jerome Powell wondering what he's going to do. And everyone in finance is literally now reading tea leaves to determine whether or not a blue tie that he wears is going to mean that the interest rates are going up or down. What really broke my brain in the last, say, month was I spend an inordinate amount of time trying to understand that sector because it has an impact on the risk-free rate of the world, which is fundamentally every investment out there. And this institution, which is meant to be held, you know, in the highest of esteem, it is our highest financial institution. This is the institution that sets the risk-free rate of interest for the world. That institution basically was 6 months late on picking up that they missed 1 million unemployed people back in June last year. And I'm like, hang on a second. They've either purposely missed it or willfully missed it. I'm not sure, and I don't want to sort of make any conjecture. That's not my bag, but what I can tell you is it's very difficult making, you know, decisions on people's livelihoods and, you know, investment decisions that are going to have an impact on people's lives when you've got people finding out 6 months after the fact, oh, we missed 1 million, you know, unemployed. Well, oh, yeah, we'll just chalk that down and we're all good now. And it's like, well, that's simply not good enough for what we deem our highest financial institution. And the frustration grows day by day when you have an understanding of Bitcoin and you can see basically the obfuscation that we work in traditional financial markets. It's not a free and fair market that we're currently working in.
And so, Pete, if we were to put Bitcoin aside for a moment, what would be some recommendations you'd be giving to clients at the moment from more of a fiat viewpoint as a portfolio today? And going back to some of the metrics you mentioned earlier about looking at earnings and things like this, for someone out there that isn't an investment advisor or that familiar with the space, you know, what kind of portfolio would you recommend to someone who wants just a medium risk 5 to 10 year hold? And how would you calculate what to buy, if that makes sense?
Well, this is going to be contentious, but if you're in investments,
try and sell me Bitcoin. Bitcoin's not allowed, Pete, all right?
You know me too well. Well, let's talk about equities then. Bitcoin miners, I'm joking. I say that facetiously, but on a serious note, this market environment is something like we have never seen before. We've never been in this environment. And with so much uncertainty, it's very difficult to make long-term decisions because you know, at the moment we're currently looking at interest rates literally going up vertically like this right now. And that level of or rate of change is not able to be maintained. So there is going to be have to be a flattening at some stage and realistically a drop at the moment. And in light of sort of effectively a shifting economic outlook, I wouldn't be doing anything right now, which is a really boring answer, but it's the right answer in these conditions. And the hardest thing to do is just sit and wait.
Wow.
And that is probably the hardest conversations we have with clients that, you know, we've got money on the sidelines with some clients and it's like, hey, we've got that money. What are we doing with it? Like you put it to work. It's like, it's just not the right time to be doing that now. We want to be waiting for clear direction from the markets. We know what the signal is. We just need to be patient and wait for it. And this is where if clients are already invested, that's a different story. You just want to be, you know, sitting and waiting with what investments you have. And if you've got cash on the side until there's a clear market direction, I don't think you want to be taking any ancillary risks that you don't have to.
And that's fair enough. So in short, like if someone came to you with, for sake of argument, and as an example only, $1 million, and they were like, Pete, I need some help with this $1 million. What do I do with it? Your advice is actually to stay in dollars for now and look to deploy it in the next 3 to 6 months in a range of assets that we believe might continue to come down given where the interest rates are going. Follow that. Completely fair enough and great answer. The hypothetical scenario, let's go forward 6 months. Let's say we have got some clarity from the Fed and the interest rate market seems to have kind of quieted down a bit. Again, taking a purely traditional view, what would you be looking to buy in terms of equities or bonds? And equally, like why should those or why do those play a part in a portfolio? And again, just to talk about the valuation process, I'd just love to understand a bit more, just at a high level, like how do you decide what to buy?
I think you want to look at return and you look at what clients are trying to achieve on a personal level. Being in Australia, we have most clients have a love affair with property. We understand property very well, you know, taught from the day we were born, you want to own your own home, you want to own property. And most of our clients are very heavily invested in property. So I'll just sort of get that on the table.
Okay.
That allows us to then look at much very different type investments that would not traditionally be looked at in a traditional advice capacity. Well,
if I could jump in before we go down to these slightly different investments. So when it comes to property, how do you guys value property? And what does a property need to look like in order for it to be interesting as a investment today?
I think it's a number of things. With property, you need to be looking at a long-term time frame. So initially, before you look at property, you need to be committed to having at least a 5 to 7 year outlook on that. And then you need to look at the liquidity considerations for that. That has undertaken a tectonic shift in the last 12 months. We had, you know, clients borrowing money at circa 2% on a commercial basis. And to go back to the bank, they're now borrowing money at 5%. So if you're buying an investment, you know, we've seen, you know, some commercial properties, pubs, retail office, you know, sort of selling as low as 4% yield. And I look at that and I think that is an exceptionally risky investment in light of what's happening, knowing that interest rates are rising, we've got a rising inflation rate. And, you know, when you've got a cost of capital rising so sharply, up until a year ago, real estate investing was relatively easy because you'd basically chip in somewhere between 30 and 50%, you know, percent of the property value, you'd borrow the rest, and the rent that you would receive on that property, less all the expenses, was still more than sufficient to pay all of the dollars that you borrowed.
And the real estate market was rising.
Correct. So this is a very different proposition when you're looking at interest rates going back up. You're looking at property prices at all-time highs, and they're probably somewhere between 5 and 20% off, depending on what area you're looking at. It's really not a positive investment outlook from a property front. And this is where I look at it. It doesn't keep me up at night, but it's a serious amount of wealth in Australia is tied up, and globally, in real estate, whether that be residential, commercial, or anything else. It's a very different value proposition from what our parents went through, because if you look at the 1980s, early 1982, we had all-time high interest rates, we had all-time low asset prices and real estate prices. Now,
this is flipped.
Effectively, 40 years, you've had asset prices going up fundamentally in a straight line. There were a few hiccups along the way, but for all intents and purposes, basically went up and to the right. And then on the flip side, you had your cost of capital starting at an all-time high, basically working its way down to effectively the zero interest rate policy, which is what we lived through for the last few years and has only recently changed in the last 12 months. So when I say there are tectonic shifts happening right now, this is literally a fundamental, like a 40-year shift. And most people in the markets haven't been through that. I know me personally, I haven't lived through that as an advisor to really deliver advice on that. And this is where delivering investment advice on that, you know, sitting on cash is not a bad thing when there is so much up in the air. Like there are so many balls up in the air. You don't want to be taking ancillary risk unless you have, you know, the bargain of a century. You don't want to be taking that commitment in this type of environment. But I look at this and I wonder, from Bitcoin's point of view, is this going to be the pivotal moment? You know, you've got a generation looking at property and thinking, all-time high property prices, all-time low interest rates. This is a shitty bet for anyone under 40. It's basically, hang on a sec, you want me to buy your bags? What we're effectively doing, anyone under 40, is fundamentally bailing out anyone over 40 from that property. And yes, there are commercial properties or working properties, whether that be farm or residential, retail, industrial, office, whatever, that is going to continue to deliver returns. But, you know, as a whole, that investment class, I think anyone entering the investment space is looking at that and thinking, this is really not a great deal for me. I don't like my chances coming out of this. And this is where debt fundamentally becomes a killer, because it's a total re-rating of an asset class. And this is where, say, bonds, to talk about an asset class that we're not particularly comfortable with, unless it's a very short-dated bond. But most clients look at bonds and think, oh, you know, can we have some bonds? Or, you know, we like the thought of bonds because it doesn't lose money. It's like, that's simply not true. Bonds are very, very risky from the perspective that, and particularly in light of the last 12 months, I think you've had long-term bonds have basically lost somewhere close to 20% and short-term bonds lost nearly 14%. And the difference between losing money in a bond fund and losing money in an equity fund is that in a bond fund, that money's never coming back. Once you lose it, it's gone. The value of the bond is literally ripped up. And, you know, understanding sort of your background in the UK a few months ago, we saw, and a client emailed me this, which was terrifying. I think it was December 2021. If you bought a 40-year gilt, which is the 40-year government bond for whatever interest rate it was, 0.5%, and if you held it for the next 9 months when that little spike went through the UK bond market, you'd effectively ripped up 75% of your capital. Ouch. If you were to sell that bond. Ouch. Or you could hold it at 0.5% interest rate for the next 39 years to recover your initial capital. Either or, you've lost.
Meantime, inflation's at what, 6%? I mean, well, more than that, frankly. So real estate doesn't sound great. Bonds don't sound great. I mean, that kind of gilt meltdown that happened just before Christmas. So inflation was still running at 10% in the UK. And the Bank of England steps in and starts fucking buying more gilts. You're like,
how's that work? Who's that benefiting? Oh, but we'll have a complete meltdown.
That happens so much quicker than I expected. And I think is a good signal that things are going to break much faster than we expected. But anyone that says that inflation is transitory or that it is going to come down, when you see actions like that, it's not. Like, it's really not. Yes, now some of the CPI figures are coming in at 6% or 6.5% rather than 9%. Okay, it's slowing down for now. But yeah, it's an extraordinary time we're living through. And that's why when you're considering making an investment and someone's trying to sell you investment advice, and they're like, yeah, we know what we're doing, it's bullshit. Because unless they're like 80 years old, like they haven't experienced it before, which means they don't know what it's like. Okay, and so let's keep working through these investment classes. I'm enjoying this, Pete. Thank you. So bonds, where would you go next?
Probably a proxy for a bond, which we've used over the last decade, has been effectively property REITs and infrastructure. We haven't done bonds in a long time. The reason we didn't do bonds was because we thought that, basically there was a huge risk of the bond market blowing up. Obviously, there's much bigger problems if that does happen. But if you look at the return profile on, say, the infrastructure assets or some of the REITs, the real estate trusts, you effectively have what looks like a bond, smells like a bond, walks like a bond, but it's not a bond. It's basically indexed to a property that effectively has a real life tangible value. So you get the benefit of basically getting a coupon like you would a bond. Yeah. However, when that property increases in value, you get an uptick in value in your bond proxy.
Yeah.
So for us, that's worked really well. Obviously, GFC, the COVID scare and the rest of it sort of put a big crink in that. But for the best part, there's been a big recovery in the drawdowns that those assets did take. But it's still concerning where we are right now relative to high interest rates and the rest of it, because those type of investments are very, very sensitive to interest rate movements, because effectively they are just a return on your equity, effectively an interest rate, much like a bond. So putting that aside, the next one we go to is equities. And equities, I think, has had a very, very interesting last 2 years, full stop. We'll call it 3 years. COVID came along, absolutely smacked everyone and everything. It was the end of the world. And then they just pumped in that QE money, which
was 4 trillion, 6 trillion, fuck, who knows?
It's just the numbers just add a zero. It's just who knows literally what it is. And basically all assets rip, particularly equities. And because on the risk curve, equities typically take a higher risk than debt. However, I would suggest at this point in time, although technically that is the case, there's a very real life difference to that. And when we look at equities, what do we look for? We want to basically be investing in the best companies in the world that have got some kind of competitive advantage over their competitors, who are going to basically outperform from a cash flow perspective and have the ability to increase margins, even in a really tough environment. And there are a number of ways we can do that. We typically use a number of fund managers to do that for us, who have been very successful over the last 10 years. However, in the last 12 months have suffered terribly at the fate of the market. However, the investments that they make aren't bad companies. They're not going out of business. There's nothing wrong with the actual companies. They're just the sentiment has changed. It's been that 40-year shift where all of a sudden you've had a punishment of anything that was slightly risky or on the growth curve. And so I think the market has somewhat missed or over-punished a lot of these growth stocks. And I'll just share with you one of the things that we've worked with. I think the market is thinking that a growth stock has high debt, high working capital requirements, and as such is going to get punished. The earnings are going to be punished higher or in a much more debilitating way because of their debt and working capital requirements. However, I just want to shift that. I think that's a traditional mindset, because Post-2010, there was a complete shift in what a growth stock was. Pre-2010, a growth stock was typically a fast-growing company that required huge amounts of working capital, huge amounts of debt, and as such, they were very sensitive to any interest rate changes. However, post-2010, and I'm talking after the GFC and after the 2000 dot-com bubble, you had the growth stocks now were companies that had zero cost per additional unit of production. Mm-hmm. You effectively had tech companies as the growth stocks.
Software businesses, yeah.
And they don't have working capital requirements. They don't have huge debt facilities. If you look at, you know, the largest cash balances across the S&P 500, they're all tech companies.
Yeah.
And so this is where I think maybe the market has overpunished the growth companies and underplayed what punishment should be dealt out or what discount should be dealt out to value companies, because up until 2010, value companies had very little debt and very little working capital requirements. They just chugged along when they delivered whatever they delivered. And the growth stocks had the huge requirements for debt and working capital. And in a rising interest rate environment, that is a death sentence. It gets very expensive and it cripples your earnings very quickly. And then you look at post-2010, all of these growth companies, or the majority of them, have effectively no working capital requirements. They've got cash on hand. They're making more money now than they were before because they've got literally earning 4 or 5% interest from the treasury on their cash at bank. And all of a sudden, this paradigm shift of a growth stock being belted in a rising interest rate environment is basically what we've known for millennia up until this point in time. And there's, I think, a sea change happening with that. And so what I think is going to be very interesting to see is how value stocks are going to hold up when earnings start dropping, because it's the value stocks that have got, you know, much larger debt positions on their balance sheet and much higher working capital requirements than the growth stocks. So last 12 months, growth stocks got absolutely hammered. That was on effectively a price earnings contraction. So you had a market cap contracted because rather than being on a 30 times price earnings multiple, you basically were on it got crushed down to, say, in the case of Facebook, that went from 30 to 12 times.
Wow.
And it's like, well, that's like a 60% contraction.
It's
in
big
multiple.
So,
and that's how you calculate the value of the stock. However, you know, cash at bank, I'm not going to go into sort of the decision-making process that they've gone internally with Meta and Metaverse and the rest of it. It's like, I think that stuff's, you know, not my bag, but still I don't think it deserved to be punished like it did. It still can be a fabulous business with very little debt requirements. So
I read today 3 billion users.
Remarkable.
It's fucking crazy, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Like, a lot of people think the internet is Facebook, right?
Yeah. It's they got a search function.
It's like, got... you don't need a browser. You don't do anything. Everything is done in Facebook. That's just the internet.
I mean,
wow.
Spectacular, really.
Isn't it? Yeah. I mean, screw you, Zuckerberg, psycho. So equities, to continue along that line. So let me simplify slightly. You've got $1 million, wherever you got it from, you inherited it, you made it. It's just a number I picked out of thin air. But to decide how to deploy that money is very hard. And you're talking with 20 years of experience of, you know, having your head fully immersed in the investment world, in debt, in equities. And your job is literally to help people navigate that. And I love that. It's a really important role. And it's been 100% necessary in a world which we were born into, where there's a central bank that can print its own money. And therefore, we're in an inflationary monetary scenario where our cash means we can't save. So we have to invest. But saving and investing are not the same thing.
No.
And we don't realize that. We think that actually we have to always invest. You must get your money working, is the phrase your client, you know, used, as you mentioned. But along comes Bitcoin, and that's going to change things. So how does that fit into this scenario that you're explaining now, which is essentially the extremely difficult proposition any capital allocator has to save purchasing power over time?
Yeah.
Like, all of these different asset classes are under serious stress. And yes, either you hit lucky in the equities market with some kind of undervalued stock that no one realized or whatever, but that takes extreme skill or pure luck. And if you're any average person, which is most people, you're not a stock expert. So how in the hell are you supposed to save your money over time?
This is a very good question, Jake. And I don't have any great answers for you. I will tell you what we do, though, is On a personal note, and this is not financial advice, this is just something I do personally. And, you know, I think it's very important that whatever I do for myself, we deliver to our clients. But I think it's very important, first of all, the most important thing that my clients can do when we first speak to them is get comfortable with some allocation to Bitcoin. It is my number one prereq. I spend more time talking about Bitcoin with clients than any other asset, even if they've got a 5% weighting to it and we're looking after 95% in other things. Because what I don't think a lot of people realize or understand is that this is the only out that we have. And the better understanding you have of Bitcoin, the more comfortable you will feel buying more of it. And the more you buy of it, the more comfortable you will feel and in control of that process. And this is where there are two different choices that clients can take, where I literally ask them, you know, we've been doing this for a while, like we've been advising clients to buy Bitcoin since maybe 2016. So it's been a few years now. And when we first brought this up, it was a very subtle conversation around, hey, we think this might be a good exposure for you, have a very little weighting to it, something that's not going to change your life, something that's not going to impact you if it goes south, be fully prepared for it to go to zero. But we think, hey, having 1 to 2% of your net assets in there is going to be a good idea. And that conversation has shifted, you know, in 7 years from, hey, you should have a little bit of that to, you really need to have at least a 2 to 5% weighting in that. And I've only told one client not to buy Bitcoin when they wanted to add to their position. And I think it was a fair reason not to. And that was because there was a threat of divorce from his wife if he was to buy any more. And I'd rather lose the battle than the war. So for that reason, it was, hey, we've got plenty of Bitcoin. We can talk about something else. Shout out to
whoever that legend is somewhere else.
Yeah.
You're right, Pete. Yeah. No, and this is a very, very important part of the equation. Absolutely.
And this is where, you know, from an advice process, you want to start. I want to start my conversations there because fundamentally we have long-term relationships with our clients that, you know, we're going to be working together for the next 10, 20 years. Mm-hmm. In thinking about that type of time frame, the biggest impact that we can have on a client's investments and finance is going to be getting them comfortable with as much Bitcoin as possible from an early perspective. So once we're able to have that conversation with clients, get them comfortable, and then try and push them up that percentage of their allocated assets, it's a much more meaningful conversation, particularly during a bear market. Clients are very happy that we have spent that time on that. But I think in this environment, it's much easier to have that conversation now than it was previously, because when you go through all of the other asset classes and realize how much trouble or potential risk is involved in all the other assets, it's a far easier conversation to be having that, you know, well, equities, all-time highs, it's really hard. Earnings are going to come off this year. What's that going to do? We don't know. Bonds, I mean, we've just gone through the worst bond market in the last 100 years globally. And then you look at property and you think downstream of the bond market. So it's going to be property's turn to have a hit this year. So having a conversation around Bitcoin, which has taken a 70% drop and it's still working in the last 12 months, is probably one of the easier conversations in finance that we've got at the moment.
Yeah, brilliant. Again, thank you, Pete, for your help. I've been in discussions with my brother and my sister, my mom and my family investment trusts, and trying to get some Bitcoin allocated there. And it is a real challenge if you have difference of opinions or different worldviews, and you look at the bond market and you see risk and other people see safety. It's really hard to persuade people or to cajole people or to become not the overbearing brother who's like, just buy more Bitcoin, come on. But having someone like yourself who understands Bitcoin extremely well and is able to, with all the acumen you have from 20 years as a financial advisor, bring to the table, it's a really, really impressive way actually of teaching people about why Bitcoin's important. Pete, to try and take a bit more of a personal turn to this, so thank you for teaching us about all those different areas. How has Bitcoin changed your life or changing?
That's a great question. That's a very deep question, Jack. It's had a profound impact on my life, and it has effectively torn a hole in the fabric of reality for me. And it's given me a lens to look at things in a completely different way. Being in and around Bitcoin for, you know, a number of years now and going down this rabbit hole, you look at the fundamental promise of Bitcoin, and it fundamentally is a trust machine or a truth machine. and, you know, nothing can change it back to that pet rock. And then it gives you time to reflect on, you know, your own life and what you're doing. And I often joke that, you know, and it's an often said saying in Bitcoin, you don't change Bitcoin, Bitcoin changes you. It's on the deepest level, that is fundamentally what happens. You know, you look at things in a very, very different light. I just look at it from a work context, from a family context, from just about every facet of my life. It's had an influence because it fundamentally changes your brain. It deprograms your brain from what we've all grown up with. We shared that comment earlier in the conversation that, you know, I want to be an investment banker and earn $1 million a year. Like, I just think, I look back on that and think, what a wanker. Like, who wants to do that? Really? Is that the best purpose your life can serve? And
mate,
no.
Gordon Gekko is a cool dude. So, you know, we've all watched the movie. Why not?
He is a cool dude. And, you know, it's very aspirational, but really, is that the best use of your time? And you sort of, yeah. You know, I look around and I had a conversation recently looking to write a book. And I looked around and, you know, it was going to require a huge amount of time. And then on the back end of that, there was going to be effectively a promotion and push it and conversations literally globally about this. And I just came to the realization, for what? Yeah. Why do I want to put more on my plate? Most people are sort of trying to take things off their plate. And I can't remember if this was the conversation or not, but or just hearsay, but it was a conversation reportedly or a story about Bill Gates and Warren Buffett talking. And, you know, Bill Gates showed Warren his diary and it was basically schedule. I've got my meeting scheduled, my PA sorts it all out. That's wonderful. What's yours look like? And Warren just looks, it's empty. Is, yeah. You know, the ultimate flex is, you know, time and flexibility. And this is where you look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin fundamentally changes you from a consumer mindset mm-hmm. to effectively a building mindset or a much longer term mindset that, you know, I think it's deterministic that Bitcoin basically assumes all the value in the world that we have right now and goes up exponentially in value. It's just a matter of when that is going to happen. And then
it makes a lot of sense, that rationale. Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's hard to unsee it once you've seen it. And then that allows you to make very different decisions in your life rather than, oh, I need a new pair of shoes or I need this or I need that. It's like, well, I don't really need anything. I've got everything I want. You know, I've got a lovely family, beautiful kids, great relationships in my life. I can spend time, you know, with these gorgeous people in my life. And that's real wealth.
What a brilliant answer. Thank you, Pete. And something I'd love to chime with on the shoes, small example, but when I first read the Bitcoin Standard and Saifedean was talking about time preference, little did I know that time preference is a discussion that Austrian economists have had for, you know, centuries, right? But it's the first time I really came across it. And at the time, I was very interested in how to try and solve climate change and the problem with consumerism and long-term resource management. And I'd done some angel investing in clean tech companies and had gone very, very deep down the hole of like how we might do this, and ultimately came as a regulation play. And, you know, if we have to hit sub 2 degrees warming, then, you know, a whole lot of regulation is going to come in place. And therefore, all these companies are going to someday have to go green. And therefore, buying green technology at an early stage now is a good idea. And it was a really interesting process. I loved it. I wouldn't want to change it for the world. But when I suddenly realized, like, hang on, so why have I never looked at the money before as a problem? And then it was like, hang on, so if I can tell someone that they buy this today and they're not going to lose it over time, and you flip that purchasing power problem around, oh, hang on, fucking hell, like that's radical. But that actually might work. You know, all these pricks flying into Davos and telling you how you should live your life and all the rest of it, and you suddenly, the whole veil like almost pulls away, and you're like, well, none of that makes any sense whatsoever, but this Bitcoin thing really might actually potentially work, even though it seems crazy. So that resonates with me a lot. The point being is, you know, in a fiat mindset, those Nike Air Max today at $200, if you don't buy them today, well, next year they're going to be $250. So you can buy 3/4 of a pair of shoes. So you've got to buy them right now. And so people are incentivized to spend the little money that they do have. And you look at these crazy stats about something like 50% of Americans have no savings.
Yeah.
Why is that? Well, because there's no point saving. And they're not financial advisors, so they don't know how to fucking buy the right stocks. The whole thing's a complete mess.
Yeah.
And that's why Bitcoin's so exciting to me, because it's just so simple. And someone like yourself that's able to share what you've done today, by listening to your story, by listening to the way that you view the world and the skills that you have in place to help manage other people's wealth, the fact that you're interested in Bitcoin, that is good due diligence. It's like I can sit alongside a brain like yourself and go, okay, I know that he's done enough work in traditional asset classes that if he's looking at this as more valuable than all of them right now, that means something. Maybe go learn some more. Yeah, love it. Okay, nice one. Any comments, Pete? Go for it.
I do. And this is where Bitcoin is game-changing from, say, that climate change perspective, from wealth perspective. It is a complete game-changer in that it is an alignment of incentives. And our traditional finance world typically doesn't have aligned incentives. And this is what I take issue with, is that, you know, there is not really an alignment. You know, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Bitcoin is very simple, and it taps into our most basic of human traits, which is greed and fear. Literally, on a primordial level, we are motivated by fear or greed. And this is where Bitcoin, ironically, solves or has the potential to help solve climate change by just making everyone so freaking greedy that all they want to do is buy Bitcoin. And by buying Bitcoin, then you're potentially helping the environment by, you know, flared methane and all sorts of beneficial things for our environment. And at the same time, all you're doing is tapping into our most basic of natures, which is a fundamentally greed driver. And all of a sudden, everyone's incentives are aligned. And this is what I look at and think, say, Thomas Strohlite's work has been outstanding in this, in really sort of understanding what an alignment of incentives can actually do for us as a society. And this is where the societal impact and change will really come in, over and above just the monetary benefits and the number go up technology it has. For the first time in history, I think, because it is immutable, because you can't change it, you can't influence it, it allows everyone in society to build around that. And then all of us in society who build on that platform, that unchangeable little pet rock, all of a sudden, everyone's incentives are aligned. And this is an opportunity to look at, for humanity's sake, that for the first time in history, we have the ability to align everyone's interests.
And so, Pete, to draw it right the way back to where we're at the start of the conversation about a triple entry bookkeeping system, like, how profound an innovation is this for humanity? Like, as a wider context, like, I love this idea that, like, what's good for Bitcoin is good for the world. Like, why is that?
Oh, that's a very big question. I'll try and answer it.
We've not got a huge amount of time left, to be honest, Pete. So don't go too deep into it. But what I was trying to chime with there is, this is a big deal for the average person. Like, perhaps, like, try and draw a conclusion to our conversation today as to why that's the case.
Well, I think it can have a profound impact, not only on yourself, but on society. And at the same time that it's having a beneficial and altruistic benefit to everyone in your life and broader community, you know, there is the potential that it could make you really, really rich. And I haven't met someone who doesn't want more money, because it's true. Like, everyone wants more money. Like, you can never be too good looking and you can never have enough money. So, you know, on the most basic of needs from a humanitarian perspective, it solves a lot of problems. And looking at it from a Maslow's needs hierarchy, there are certain needs that need to be met. To basically climb up that Maslow's needs hierarchy to effectively self-actualization and being able to give to humanity, I think Bitcoin allows us to scale that hierarchy of needs faster than anything else on Earth.
Awesome. And I've got one last question, which I cannot find right now. Our friend, Mr. Nathan Smith, he says, what is the second best crypto?
There is no second best.
Brilliant. Well, Pete, thank you so much for joining me on Bitcoin with Jake. Where can people reach out and get in touch if they want to do so?
Twitter's the best place, @Dunworth_Peter. And I'm pretty good at getting back to any messages there, but that's about it. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Pete, thank you so much for joining today.
Great to see you. Thank you for having me. Keep up the great work.
Okay, friends, nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best. Jake.